Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we've got some good news and some bad news.
Yeah, it's always something.
It is always something.
You're afraid to get out of bed in the morning. For what blight may affect us next?
No,
trees,
kidding.
Bugs, plants, oil?
No kidding. And we've got all that stuff coming up, too. So
yeah, right.
Stay by your radios. But for today, we'll start with the good news first, Bob.
Okay.
I'll let you take that. Lavender.
Yeah, a man named Andy Van Helvigen, he and his wife own a lavender nursery in Oregon, and it's a local nursery, so they can't ship here, but he knows a great deal about the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a fun plant. I've had mixed luck with it. You've had better, of course, but the problem is in our Ohio River Valley climate, you need a particular kind of cultivar to grow that does better than others.
Right.
And he talks about that. It's worth trying. It really is. It's a neat plant.
It's like stick with the English types of lavender,
right.
The angustifolia, but because I have tried that Spanish one that has like the little cute top to it. I love it, but it never makes it. So it must be the humidity thing. But I have had good luck with Munsted. So.
It can't be your green thumbs.
But I'm okay with the whole live and learn, and you got to kill a few plants here and there too. So
you grow Munsted and the
Hidkit,
yeah.
So I think that's what most people probably have around here. But we're going to find out more beyond what we know.
And the bad news.
Mike Armstrong, who is the Southeast White Nose Syndrome Coordinator, official. I mean, if that's your official title, that the syndrome is serious, right?
Yeah.
But he's in Frankfurt, and he's going to explain to us what's going on with the bats. Some of you may have, seen some of the news stories, how caves are closing.
Indiana, for sure.
Why they're closing. They're doing the same thing in Kentucky.
Right.
And it's pretty much at this point in Indiana and Kentucky, a preemptive sort of measure to stop the spread of this white nose syndrome, which is a fungus that's killing. They discovered it in 2006, Bob, and over 1 million bats have died since then. And they're not exactly sure what's going on, so there's a great deal of effort and coordination between researchers and whatnot to try to figure it out. So we're gonna get an update from Mike Armstrong and try to understand it ourselves.
Yeah, we're going to be down to roaches and crabgrass another 50 years. Nothing else left on this planet.
Oh, no. I'm far more optimistic than that.
Oh, I am too, really.
All right, Bob, what is going on in your garden?
My tiny little dahlias are doing great. These are ones, I mentioned these before, that I'll sneak around to box stores from time to time when they sell them for like $1, the little bitty ones, little packages of the things. I bring them home and I deadhead them and I put them out in the garden, and they bloom wonderfully all summer.
And then do you leave them in there?
No, I try and the little guys, I'll dig them up.
Oh.
And even the bigger guys. I also plant some bigger dahlias. Mm-hmm. I'm a dahlia nut. But it does take a little more work than I sometimes have the time to deliver to them.
Right.
And I have said the heck with it a couple of times, but not this year. I'm going to try and salvage these guys.
It is a great summer bloom, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's just so easy. All you do is deadhead it.
Uh-huh. And it keeps on blooming.
That's about it. It'll bloom
and they're
forever
bold
and ever and ever.
Mm-hmm.
And the dwarfs will fool you and get like a foot tall if you don't watch them.
It's true.
Or 2 feet.
Dwarf is relative, right?
Yeah, again, plants can't read.
That's right.
How about the wish you stay? What's up?
Well, I'm...
I smell tragedy.
Well, I think I diverted it.
Oh.
Let's see. Emergency potato digging on Friday. It was one of those things totally under duress. It's like I have to dig all of my potatoes right now.
Faith in Bogota last.
I dropped off a sample, pulled up a plant and put it in a bag and took it to the extension service.
Okay.
So I will get confirmation as to what the problem was. But I suspect...
Uh-oh.
I had late blight.
The Irish potato famine.
The Irish potato famine.
Oh, my gosh.
And basically, late blight, it'll impact the foliage first, and then it'll end the stems, and then the spore. And, weather has to be right. I got my potatoes in really early in the season, so I think they could have been infected then, because actually heat and humidity, the high heat, is not favorable conditions, quite frankly. It's more, if you think about it, Maine and Ireland...
Yeah.
Those sorts of temperatures, kind of cloudy, misty.
I've been to both a lot.
That's the ideal conditions for late blight, which is Phytophthora infectans. How about that?
Yeah.
So on the foliage, then on the stems, then the spores get washed down into the soil, and then they infect the potatoes.
How about your neighbors? Any reports of similar problems or anybody else?
I don't think anybody has a big vegetable garden like me around.
That's true.
So
I'm going to check mine tonight.
I'll get confirmation if if it is or not for sure, but like the foliage looked awful, and then it got worse like in a matter of a day.
And the whole, your whole planting, all of them.
Well, I have three different varieties.
Okay.
I have Caribe, which looked the worst foliage wise. Then I have this one called Prairie Blush, which is supposed to be resistant, and in fact it was because it didn't have hardly any. Then my Swedish Fingerlings had a little bit of it, but they're the potatoes that I've got more rotting potatoes of right now.
Yeah.
So I got everything dug. I'm monitoring them in and, you know, spread out in the garage in their baskets for their cure, because I don't think they're going to cure very well or store very well since I dug them early. But we'll just eat lots of potatoes for every night for dinner, right?
Are they about half as big as you might expect?
No.
They're pretty well full.
They're pretty well, yeah, because I planted them March 15th.
That's right.
So they were plenty big. I would have probably had a little bit of a higher yield. And really, I think more than anything else, the disadvantage, if everything doesn't rot, will be that they weren't in the ground long enough to get that harder skin, so to speak, so that they will store for the maximum amount of time they could store. So I'll just have to use them up more quickly. So what happened with the potato famine, Bob? Once they dug their potatoes, they put them into storage. They went back to get their potatoes, and they were all rotten.
Yep.
So this is why I'm monitoring them, because basically if the fungus gets into the potato literally rots in a matter of a couple of days.
And the British were no help either, believe me.
Yeah. And I did have a couple.
They weren't.
I did have a couple of the Swedish fingerlings. They looked like they were hit the worst in terms of the tubers.
Wow.
So all of that's gone to extension, and we will let you know what the determination
serious stuff.
It is serious stuff. I don't want that in my garden.
No.
That's why I needed to get it all out. I bagged it up, and Andy took the bags to the dumpster.
We need some more good news then. How about
let's start with good news.
Let's talk about lavender.
Let's do talk about lavender.
We'll talk to Andy Van Helvigen, co-owner of Van Helvigen Herb Nursery in Oregon, where along with his wife Melissa, he grows and sells more than 100 varieties of lavender, including many he bred and developed himself. He's past president of the Hardy Plant Society of Oregon and often lectures on lavender and other herbs. Andy, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you.
How does a guy get into growing lavender and herbs? I'm always curious about these things.
Well, I'm a third-generation nurseryman that was originally in bulbs and then went to roses and holly with my family. But I met this woman in high school.
Uh-oh.
She was the leading Oregon herbalist.
Ah.
And she was probably in her 80s from Kennebunk, Port, Maine. And I just became her protege. And
wow.
She introduced me to lavenders, and it stuck with me. And then, like most plant growers, we try to collect everything that comes our path.
Yeah, all you want is one of everything.
There
right?
is a certain profile when it comes to plant people, isn't there?
Yes.
Obsession is part of
psychosis,
it.
Psychosis, whatever the word is for.
By hook or by crook.
So you run a nursery that specializes in herbs with your wife in Oregon. One of the things that you all specialize in beyond that are varieties of lavender.
Yes.
How many different varieties of lavender are there?
They're being named constantly and daily, but I would say you could probably easily say 300.
Okay.
Wow. Well, give us some history, Andy, of lavender. I know it goes back thousands of years and you know where it came from and its use, many uses up to now.
Yeah, I think the first recorded history was Dioscorides the Greek, and I think that was 5th or 6th century.
Mm-hmm.
He mentioned it in his herbal. But mostly the lavender stoicus or stoicus that was known way back when by the Greeks and the Romans, and that's the lavenders they thought that they used in their Roman baths. And it's not like your typical English lavender. It's what they call the butterfly lavender or the ones with the big bracts. And
right. Oh.
The Romans called it stickador, which loosely translated stick a dove, which was like it looked like a bird with a stick through it.
You know what? It does. It absolutely does.
And it was very camphorous. And so I think, you know, way back when, you know, prior to the Middle Ages, anything that smelled good was jumped on. And so that's what they used in the Roman baths.
Okay.
And then jumping ahead, probably the 11th century, Hildegard, I think she was an abbot. Or abbotess, I guess, mentioned it. And that was the first botanical listing.
Oh.
And then from then, that just sort of went in and out of the medieval times, mostly in monasteries and physic gardens.
So did it have any, okay, we know that it can make us not smell so bad.
Yeah. Well,
and the oils in it can, you know, but does it have any other, like, medicinal quality other than a soothing sort of skin and refreshing fragrance? Or is there any medicinal value?
Lately, a lot of the publicity is its soothing effect.
Mm-hmm.
Aromatherapy people say, you know, it relieves stress and, you know, it's put in a lot of products. A lot of people just use it in oils. In fact, I had one friend that had a mustache, and he was a college professor, and he would just put a drop on his mustache to get through the day.
Before he had to go lecture.
Right.
That's awesome.
I wonder what his students did.
Yeah. And then topically, it's used to relieve swellings, especially insect bee stings and spider bites like that.
Cool.
Is there any great folklore with it? I mean, would it chase away witches or bring good luck or anything like that? Do you know?
I think everybody agrees Lavon means to wash,
right.
And it was used in the linens. And I think not only to scent the linens and stuff, but it actually was, you know, a slight moth repellent, too. So.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
But I think, you know, everybody that smells it likes it, so.
Sure. Culinary. This was something that I discovered just a couple of years ago when I started drying some herbs to make, like, a herb de Provence mix.
Right.
And some of the recipes called for lavender, and I was surprised, and and I shouldn't have been surprised, quite frankly, but I was surprised because I, you know, of all the herbs, I never, you know, you have lavender more for that, the fragrance part of it, and then things that we've spoken about, but I never really considered cooking with it as much, and it was wonderful, dried with some other herbs mixed in.
Yeah, that's actually probably one of the major trends in the last 5 years.
Okay.
The pushing of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I must confess, I've yet to eat something that I've enjoyed with lavender in.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe that's why the mixture, do you know what I mean? With the
there's two things, too, that
herbs.
When you get down into the lavender classes,
mm-hmm.
the lavandins, which is a cross between angustifolia and latifolia, are much more camphorous. And the angustifolias are much more floral in their scent.
Okay.
And people are using either one for cooking. And camphor is a strong taste. And so you have to be a little wary or leery of using that because it might be overpowering.
Okay, so just a little bit goes a far way.
But there has been, I mean, there was a woman in New Jersey that emailed us and named a dessert after Melissa because she used Melissa lavender in it.
Oh, nice.
And it was an English dessert called trifle, and she thought it was the best, you know, lavender out there for, mm-hmm. for culinary.
Yeah. I know people have put a little lavender in their lemonade as well.
Yeah, exactly. There's, mm-hmm. And actually, I've seen, I think the Australians and the New Zealanders are marketing a martini mix with lavender.
Of course.
But, I mean, you can put anything with a martini.
No kidding.
Yeah, after four or five, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of cultural, when I first called you up to discuss this topic, you mentioned the humidity in the Ohio River Valley as if lavender just wouldn't work here. Is that a general consensus among lavender growers? Too much humidity is bad for the plant?
Well, definitely. From what I gather from the growers back there, you probably can't grow any of the silicus varieties very well,
mm-hmm.
or what they're considered the Spanish ones, because they just wilt in the humidity.
I have tried and failed.
Right. And so you have to, they'll take temperatures easily. You just have to modify for back east with the humidity to give them plenty of full sun, plenty of ventilation,
mm-hmm.
and then either put them in a raised bed or put some sort of reflective mulch underneath it,
okay.
Oh, yeah.
Either a white sand or oyster shell or something which will actually kick light into the ground of the plant and dry it out faster.
Huh. Interesting.
And keep insects away, actually, too.
Uh-huh.
That's neat.
So drainage, is that one of the things that they demand as well? Really,
yeah.
Really good drainage?
That's probably the key to hardiness.
Mm-hmm.
They'll take any temperature, but if they have sort of wet feet, as they say, it's disastrous for them. They'll get root rot.
Yeah.
And fungal diseases.
Uh-huh. So, Andy, I think at least around here, Hidkit is probably one of the more popular English lavenders that people grow in their gardens successfully.
Right.
But as you said, there are 300 different varieties. So give us an idea of some other ones that might be interesting and unusual for us to try to grow here.
Well, I can list quite a few.
I know. It's an
probably not available
question.
To you. But,
oh, okay.
Hidcote is the classic darkest purple of the angustifolias. And the angustifolias have the largest color range, from pure white through some whitish pinks, to blues, to deep purples. And Hidcote, before the last 10 years, was probably the classic purple, but since then, there's other cultivars that are equally as dark. Royal Velvet, Tucker's Early Purple, Betty's Blue, and a nice one from England called Imperial Gem. So if you want that dark purple, those would be the cultivars. And I just read from a California grower that she thought Munstead tolerated the heat and
yes,
the best.
I think it does, yeah.
And the trouble with Munstead is probably 40 years ago you could get true Munstead, and then when the big companies jumped on it, they started seed producing it. So you're getting not true Munstead, and actually it's been reclassified as just Angustifolia compacta, which is sort of a generic form.
So how would we know if we were getting true Munstead or not? We just won't, really?
You probably won't unless
it's through some sort of...
Yeah, it's you know, it's like any plant buyer. You go to your favorite nursery and you trust that they are selling you the correct plant, and they, you know, encourage your trust, and you give them your trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and there are a few, four or five people in the U.S. that have, you know, gone out of their way to bring back the true generic varieties. And that's what we're known for locally is our nursery. I think I only do one from seed, which was a species, and all the other vegetative propagation or cloning, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Are they relatively easy to do, the cuttings and propagation?
Yeah. Very easy. It just depends on your system when you can take them. I find it's the easiest for me to take them in the fall or late fall, and other friends take them early spring.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Andy. How about give us a couple of white and pink cultivars that might be nice to add to the garden?
Well, there's on the Angustifolias, which are the typical English ones that are about knee-high when they flower, dwarf white is very nice. And then there's a new one called Blue Mountain White from New Zealand. On the pinks, the classic like Hidcote is Jean Davis. But for here, in our wet climate, it tends to get real black foliage in the winter. So I would go probably with some of the newer English varieties, Miss Catherine or Melissa to some extent, because it's got pink and white flowers. And there's another nice
sounds
little
pretty.
One called Little Lottie.
All right. So, okay, couple more questions in terms of taking care of our lavender. I know that in the spring of the year, people are sort of anxiously awaiting to see if they, you know, leaf back out and if they've made it over the winter. When's the best time to do a little, you know, cleanup pruning to really get them to continue to perform well over the years?
From the get-go, you have to rather hard prune them.
Okay.
They usually come into full production their third year, and then they'll last 5 to 7 or 10 years after that. But most people will get them, and they don't really realize that they are a shrub, and they will get woody, and like sort of a rhododendron, they'll lose all their foliage at the bottom and just have a canopy on top, and then people try to cut them back, and they
kill them.
So you can always do hard shearing from the get-go. You're in good shape.
Okay.
And then undoubtedly, you'll get mechanical damage from either, you know, snowfall or a dog or whatever, and you should just cut out those broken.
Okay. So hard pruning in the beginning and then just, like, shear pruning
and
as
annual
maintenance.
Shearing.
In the spring
the only
of the
thing
year?
Is you don't want to prune too hard late in the summer because you don't want to encourage too much new growth that's going to get chopped back by an early frost.
Okay.
Can you extend the season with different cultivars that might bloom a little earlier and later in the season?
Yeah, I mean, I almost have year-round lavenders blooming when I have my species in my greenhouse.
Wow.
The species usually will free-flower, and the stoicus or cecus will free-flower throughout the summer. The angustifolias usually are the first ones to bloom in June, and then the lavendins later in July, but there are probably about 6 or 7 angustifolia varieties that will rebloom, and you'll usually get maybe a third of the production that you would in June, sometimes in mid September or so.
Yeah. One final question: your wife is named Melissa. You mentioned a lavender named Melissa. Is there any connection here?
Right. Actually, she. We were working out in the field, and there was a pink spore off of blue flowering lavender, and so we just propagated that, and then it just remained true, and it actually has pink and white flowers, and then it got quite a name for being the culinary, and then also there's a lot of local people have been doing oil out of it as well.
Great.
Well, hang on to her.
All right. Both of them, right? Thank you, Andy. We appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
Andy Van Helvigen is co-owner and manager of Van Helvigen Herb Nursery in Oregon. For more information on lavender, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Mike Armstrong joins us to explain white nose syndrome in bats. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Lavender blue, dilly dilly. Lavender green.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we're talking emerald ash borer, oil spills, and now
and
bats.
White nose syndrome.
Yeah.
This is something, if you've heard about some cave closures.
Indiana, for sure.
In Indiana and Kentucky. They're doing some in Kentucky as well, Bob. It's basically a preemptive measure to help to try to stave something that's been termed white nose syndrome, which is a fungus that's attacking bats. And in some places, like in the Northeast, Bob, where they have these huge hibernacula, which is a fabulous word, but these are the caves where the bats hibernate, they've had 90 to 100% of the bats actually die over the winter because of this white nose syndrome. So clearly something that we wanted to find more about. So we've got Mike Armstrong, who's with us. He, in fact, is the Southeast coordinator for the white nose syndrome with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. And he's going to bring us up to date, basically, with what they know so far, because there still are a great many questions. Mike, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Sure.
Looking forward to it.
Good. Before we discuss the white nose syndrome, can we get a little bit of a snapshot of bats in America and, you know, what their normal behavior is? Because we were just talking here amongst ourselves about bats, and we find them sleeping in my garage during the day.
Sure.
We found them, you know, in the wintertime in wood piles in the barn. You know, so what is a typical bat going to do within a season and in a year?
Okay. There's approximately 46 species of bats in North America. Most of the bats that we have in North America are insectivorous bats, which means they feed solely on insects.
Mm-hmm.
So many of the times, you know, most time when people see bats flying around, they're out foraging for insects just right at dusk. We also have some bats, especially in the western and southwestern parts of North America and parts of the country, that are fruit-eating bats. So those bats also play a vital role as pollinators of different plants, has a large economic value with some of the plants that they pollinate, and they also function in seed dispersal. So that gives us a little bit of an idea about how many bat species we have, and then also just generally what type of
behavior, what type
of predator they are.
Do any bats ever hunt during the day anywhere? It's just a totally nocturnal creature.
They are nocturnal creatures, Bob. Mm-hmm.
They
absolutely are.
So I want to understand sort of the active season and the hibernating season too, Mike, because it seems like the white nose syndrome is predominantly spreading when they're hibernating. Is that true?
Well, it's true as far as we know.
Okay. There's still lots of questions, huh?
There are. And, you know, it's basically the majority of our bats hibernate during the winter. The majority of bats enter into what we call torpor, where they slow down their metabolism during the coldest times of the year. Now, many of our bat species do that, find caves and houses and other places that they will hibernate at or enter into torpor. Mm-hmm. And many, especially across the northern part of the country, they'll hibernate for months. You know, they'll go in, at least here in Kentucky. We have bats moving towards the hibernacula, towards their hibernation sites, as early as middle to late September. And what they do is they swarm usually around these hibernacula. What's something that's always been fascinating about bats to me is that that's when they breed. That's when the males and the females get together. They breed just before entering hibernation.
So the fact
and then the females have actually delayed fertilization. Until the spring when they come back out. So we have hibernating bats that truly hibernate in caves and houses and other places like that. We also have bats that just live out on the landscape. Some very common bat species that we have, the red bat, for example, is one of them here in Kentucky that most people see. And it enters into periods of torpor, but it basically does so just out on the landscape. It finds south-facing slopes. You know, here we have a prevalence of cedar trees and things like that. They will just roost in trees in sunny spots and still enter into torpor. But it's not all of our bats go into caves.
Okay, so the
during the winter to hibernate.
The red bat could have been the one that I found in the wood pile in the winter.
Yes.
So is
absolutely. They will also hibernate under the leaf litter and other places. That's exactly right.
So is that could that bat be safer?
It could be. That's one of the things that we're really interested in, continuing to watch those populations as well, not just the bats who hibernate in caves, because you know we believe that they could be safer. It's a situation where they're not entering into hibernation for long periods of time. They're not in that environment where white-nose syndrome appears to persist and really thrive. In those caves where it's colder temperatures and it has higher humidities and more moisture in the air. And also, they typically wake up more, during the wintertime. Now, even our bats that go in, enter into hibernation, naturally wake up. They arouse from those torpor bouts throughout the winter. Research in the past has suggested that's maybe around 12 to 14 times during a winter. So it's normal for them to wake up, and they'll move about the cave a little bit, and then they'll go back and enter into another torpor, usually about once or twice a month.
Tell our listeners exactly what this is. We're talking about fungus, geomyces, destructans. What is white-nose syndrome, and what do we know about it?
Sure. Well, white-nose syndrome, it's a new disease that, basically, up in New York, back in 2006, this Geomyces destructans is newly described. We found this fungus. Researchers, biologists up in New York, found this fungus growing on the noses. Noticed it growing on the noses of a few bats, and they started to look into it. They started to see some strange behaviors that were occurring in these bats. In these same caves and hibernacula, for example, they found bats flying out of the cave in the middle of the winter, middle of their hibernation. That's not normal, especially up in the north, the northeastern part of the United States and more northern climates where it gets much colder and stays colder all winter long. So they started to notice, these bats acting strangely. This fungus not only grows on the nose, it can also grow on the wing membranes, the forearms. Basically, you don't notice it growing on the bats, on their hair necessarily, but in other places on the exposed places on the bats is where it tends to grow. And what it does is that it invades into the skin tissue, is one of the things that we've learned from examining several of these bats that have contracted white-nose syndrome. And we believe that what it's doing is, I mentioned earlier that they naturally, normally awake and from torpor off and on during the wintertime. Well, they can do that and get away with that, and bats can and still survive, basically, like any critter that hibernates. You know, that in the fall, they go into hibernation as fat and healthy as they can possibly be. That's their goal.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens to them is that they've got so much fat reserves there. And when they wake up, and they do this naturally, they burn some of those fat reserves, and they're burning it throughout the wintertime. Well, what's happening is, what we believe is happening is that this fungus, Geomycetes destructans, is invading the skin tissue, and it's at the very least an irritant to the bats. It's causing them, you know, causing them to wake up, arouse much more often than they normally would, and therefore burning their fat reserves up much quicker than they normally would. And that's why we've seen such high mortality events, especially up in the Northeast so far, is because they have woken up, you know, numerous times more than normal, and they've basically burned all their fat reserves up. We believe they're leaving the hibernacula because they're basically starving to death.
Well, now, surely they've put this fungus under the microscope. Is this something new in the world, or what is it?
It's very interesting. It's not new, at least to the point that we, and this is some new information, we started to hear some reports with some of the researchers across the world in Europe last fall during that time period, that they believe that they have seen something very similar to this. And that group of researchers has started to go and look at their bat colonies over there. And we just had a meeting in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the national meeting for all the folks across the country that are working on this, and had a couple of people come over from Europe, and they gave a few presentations, and it was very interesting. What they have found is that it is the same fungus. They've determined that genetically, that it is the exact same fungus, but it doesn't appear to be affecting their bats, and it also appears to be very common in Europe. More than just one site. It appears that most of the sites that they have gone to, they found this fungus, but it doesn't seem to be affecting their bats.
So
in the same way that it's affecting ours.
So I know you don't know exactly why, but what are the thoughts as to why all of a sudden, from 2006 when it was discovered to today, they estimate over a million bats have died?
Yes.
As a result of white nose syndrome. So why is it becoming epidemic in these hibernacula caves?
Well, I guess I'll go back to the European connection first and just be a little more to that. I think that one of the next questions that we have is, you know, some of the things that we're looking into is it because our hibernacula are more populated than the hibernacula in Europe?
Oh, okay.
Is it partly because of sheer numbers, density dependence, to a certain extent, basically? We're looking at fungal thresholds for Geomycetes destructans. You know, how many spores or conidia? The fungus is the actively growing form. There's also spores that it produces. How many spores and conidia do you have to have in a particular cave in order to, you know, basically
have an outbreak?
Have an outbreak, incorrect, right. You know, and so what we've heard anecdotally from Europe is that they don't have the types of numbers. I think their largest hibernacula that they're even aware of is, they said that there are a couple of sites that have maybe upwards of 10,000 bats. You know, we have hibernacula here that have 300,000.
Oh,
there's
wow.
One in Georgia that ha- I'm sorry, not in Georgia, in northern Alabama that has over 800,000 of one species.
Wow. So overpopulation in the caves maybe, huh?
Yeah. How bad is it here? I know they're closing some caves to humans, but in Kentucky and Indiana specifically,
right?
How bad is it here?
Well, we have not yet documented the presence of white nose syndrome in Kentucky, and I do not believe it's been documented in Indiana either. You know, but it's pretty bad, Bob. I mean, it's something that we've been actively preparing for in our state ever since, really, late 2007, we've been tracking this, been involved with this. I say we here, it's you know, myself and the office here, and much more than me, the state Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources, their bat biologists. We've been doing a lot of surveillance, a lot of monitoring of our bat hibernacula and bat activity sites. A lot of education has gone on, trying to reach out to the grottos. We've actually, the grottos are the recreational caving organizations,
right,
that are spread out across the state and into other states, and just really building those relationships and working with them to help us, you know, continue to look for this. Because, you know, in our state alone, Bob, we have estimated over 3,000 caves.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got at least that many, if not more, abandoned coal mines, which serve as hibernacula for bats. There are other mines, limestone mines, gravel mines,
mm-hmm,
places like that. All of those places are hibernacula for some bats.
So, Mike, the documented cases of white-nose syndrome kind of spread throughout the U.S. into Canada, right? So it's not like it's just in the Northeast, because we're finding it in southern states and western states. Can they spread it around themselves?
They can.
So, like, do they stick to one hibernacula their entire lives, or could they, you know, jump ship and go somewhere else and then spread the disease that way?
What we know of bat, this is a great question, Janina. What we know about bat movement is somewhat limited, but we do have some pretty good information there,
mm-hmm,
and we do know. For example, let's a species that I know something about because I work with it. I'm with the Fish and Wildlife Service. My job prior to becoming the white-nose coordinator for the region was working with our endangered species, and one of those is the endangered Indiana bat.
Mm-hmm.
And the Indiana bat, as an example, in the fall, I mentioned earlier that bats swarm around these hibernacula sites, and that's when they reproduce, that's when they breed. Well, what we know about what that species does, the males actually will move around a lot within just during that fall swarming period from
sure.
cave to cave. So that species,
so yes. okay.
You know, males can transport it
mm-hmm.
from an infected cave to another cave 10 miles away, mm-hmm. you know, 15 miles away, and some distance away very easily. Now, it gets back to that fungal, the fungal load or that threshold that you need to get to. It appears that, and this is one of the things that I say, we haven't yet documented it in Kentucky. It very well could already be here. But what appears to be happening is it seems that there's a period of time, maybe 1 year, that the fungus is there, the spores are there, but it's not prevalent, it's not obvious on the bats to anyone that walks in,
mm-hmm.
even the researchers, even the biologists like ourselves that go and are monitoring the populations. You don't see the telltale, the white nose, you know, the fungus growing on the nose or the muzzles. But it could still be there. It could just be in low enough numbers that it hasn't spread enough to start really growing
mm-hmm.
actively,
hmm.
having
yeah.
the kind of an effect. Now, another example real quick, Bob, sorry to stop you, but with our species, the gray bat, it's another endangered species. Indiana bats, during the summertime, they stay on the summer landscape. They're only in caves during the winter. Gray bats are cave obligates. They spend all year in caves.
Hmm.
They move from a winter hibernacula cave
to
other summer caves. And they move around within the summer
okay.
from cave to cave. So if there's some disturbance, if someone happens to go into one of their summer caves, or if there's a flood, we've had so many floods this year, if there's a flood that pushes them out, the whole colony will pick up and move to another site. So it's very easy for bats to move
to
this.
Spread it.
And we believe that that's the main okay. avenue for this to be spread. We have seen enough anecdotal evidence that suggests that it can be spread by people,
mm-hmm.
by ourselves, by the bat researchers,
mm-hmm.
by recreational cavers by just folks visiting the caves that would then, you know, potentially go to another site.
And this is one of the reasons why many caves are now closed
right.
in Indiana and Kentucky.
That's
to
exactly
sort
right.
of preemptive measure to help.
But how long can you keep them closed?
Right.
Realistically.
Yeah. There's certainly no limit on how long we will keep them closed. First of all, we don't have the ability to close
right.
per se any cave.
Mm-hmm.
It's a recommendation that the service made, the Fish and Wildlife Service made, and many of the states are supporting, and other federal agencies, the land managers. It's a temporary cave closure. We have no interest in permanently closing these sites. The whole goal of this is to try to slow the spread of this as much as we can, do what we can to control what we can control. We can't control the bats moving
mm-hmm. right.
From cave to cave, but if we can help slow it down a little bit to buy us more times, because there's so much that we need to learn about Geomyces destructans.
In the plant world, there's been endless amounts of invasive species from Europe and so forth that killed trees here.
Sure.
Is there anything analogous to this in history where a fungus wiped out bats and then went away?
You know, not that I'm aware of. It's mm-hmm. it's I think it's been coined the most precipitous decline of North American wildlife in history.
So
already.
Okay, Mike, then, you know, a result of a dramatically diminishing bat population for our ecosystem probably has more dire consequences than people realize.
Well, it really does. You know, I mentioned earlier that most of our bats in North America are insectivorous. They feed on insects, and we have other bat species that are fruit-eating bats. These bats feed on these agricultural pests, the beetles, the mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
They can eat a single bat in an hour, in a night. They're voracious predators, can eat up to 1,000 individual insects mm-hmm. each hour.
Wow.
And as many as 3,000 in a night. And if it's a pregnant or lactating female that's nursing a baby,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it can eat its body weight in insects. So it's amazing. Yeah.
So we would be overrun with
well,
even
you know,
more insects than we don't even realize that are out there.
No wonder right. they flit around. You understand it now.
Yeah.
Bam, bam,
you
bam,
do.
Bam, bam,
they,
bam,
they,
bam.
And they're amazing that they
really are.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, we'll certainly keep up on this as you guys work hard to try to figure out what's going on.
Absolutely.
I know that there's lots of questions still, but we do appreciate your time and your expertise, and we appreciate the bat even more now, I think. Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Mike Armstrong is the Southeast White Nose Syndrome Coordinator with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here in Frankfort, Kentucky. Of course, for more information on white nose syndrome, please go to our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
And we've got a nice, not really a question, but just something interesting from a listener.
But these are questions that are really, a lot of people have, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah.
This one's from Denise, and I think she's trying to maybe confirm something that she's discussing with her husband, one of those.
Imagine that.
What's up with Japanese beetles?
Yeah.
When my husband and I built our house in Greenville, Indiana in 1994, we were seriously bugged.
Yep.
had to buy several of those bag-a-bug traps for a few consecutive summers. Now we have hardly any Japanese beetles. Were the mid-90s a time of greater infestation, or does my theory, my husband hates this, that the moles in our yards have eradicated beetle grubs? Does that have any merit? If so, she says, long live the moles, because she couldn't stand the beetles.
Well, we're in the middle of a divorce suit here, I would suspect, really. Well, really, my yard, I had the same problems. And what I've read about beetles, I think we've had people on the show, that can be somewhat territorial in a sense, that they can be bad in one place and be bad somewhere else.
And they're not so bad collectively anymore because of just general dispersal.
Right.
So they moved down this way. We got hit hard. You know, those first couple of
bad.
Years,
yeah.
They were really bad. Our daddy would get so upset, I remember.
I know.
And, you know, they've just dispersed to other places, so that helps. But I think that there is some merit, to be sure, because it's my understanding that moles first love earthworms,
yeah.
And then second, they love grubs.
So you're in the marriage counseling as well as garden advice.
This
here.
Is right. So, okay. You know, maybe not long live the moles, but the moles definitely are going to munch on a few of those Japanese beetles.
Good middle-of-the-road answer, and I agree with you 100%.
All right, this one's from Betty Bob. She has an evergreen shrub by a sidewalk that is too big.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 3 feet tall, but at the sides, it sticks out too far onto the walkway. So she would like to trim it back, you know, more than 4 to 6 inches. But if she does so, then she's going to reach into where, you know, there isn't any more foliage.
Right.
So question is, if I trim back more than those 4 to 6 inches, which is what it really needs, will new green shoots emerge in time or will it be dead?
That's a good question. My thought is if it's like a taxus or
boxwood,
like things like that, they will come back. Mm-hmm. They're almost indestructible. I think if it was a big, I don't know, I'd hesitate to try it with a pine tree or a spruce to take it all the way back inside there. But
yeah.
Some of these other tough ones, I think it would work.
Yeah. Taxus are pretty resilient.
Yeah, and arborvitae would probably take it, too.
Uh-huh.
We don't know what she's got. But I think I would wait a little later in the year. I wouldn't do it in midsummer.
Yeah. Ideal times to do some of those heavier pruning things are, you know, later in the spring. It's so hot right now.
Yes.
Is really the problem. So, but you wouldn't want to wait too late because really not anything much past mid-August because you want that new growth to emerge. And as soon as you make those cuts, especially if it is a taxus, you will encourage new growth. But you want that new growth to have a chance to harden off before the winter comes. So don't wait too late. Let it cool down a little bit here maybe, but then get it done by mid-August. All right?
And if it dies, blame it on the moles.
No. It won't. If it's a taxus, it won't die.
I know. You sometimes wish they would.
All right.
If you have a taxing question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, your Latin word of the week is something this show never is.
Oh, no.
Never.
Although it was kind of the, not dull by any means, but it was sort of sad about the bats.
It was sad.
The Latin word of the week is tristis, or trist.
Yeah.
It means dull or sad.
That's interesting because dull and sad don't have quite, that's a broad area in there.
Yeah, and it's like you don't really want to associate those things with a plant name either.
I've known some dull, happy people.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to sit next to them at dinner.
Right, so maybe dull just means that you're not really showy.
There you go.
Okay, yeah. More nondescript.
Melancholy or something.
So, Linaria tristis.
Dull-colored Linaria.
Dull-colored. Sort of like calling a dim-witted Linaria.
I can think of three college professors I had that were very tristis.
Salix, humulus, variety tristis.
Prairie willow. How can you have a dull prairie willow?
I don't know.
Doesn't sound possible.
Or maybe it's just sad.
Yeah.
Because all the prairies were gone.
Yeah, right.
Gladiolus tristis.
Marsh gladiolus.
Marsh gladiolus.
Maybe too wet for them.
Hyericium. Is that you think? Hyericium trist.
My favorite one, the woolly hawkweed.
Woolly hawkweed. Actually, I have that, I think, down in an area where I don't mow, and it's actually pretty cool.
So it's not dull at all.
No, it's maybe like the dull color. Do you know what I mean?
Because
it's kind of dusty, like the foliage is sort of dusty and woolly. Ribes, trist.
Good old ribes, the American red currant.
American red currant. And then there's a pelargonium trist, which pelargonium, of course, is
doing them
the
geranium
annual
things?
Geranium.
Yeah.
So it's maybe a dull geranium. How's that?
Impossible.
Maybe not. So, yeah, not a word that we would typically associate with a plant, but it is nonetheless a part of botanical nomenclature. Tristis, or trist, means dull or sad.
Yeah.
All right, well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Judith Jones on ferns. And we're going to learn a little bit more about fire blight and some of the other diseases that we're seeing a little more commonly this summer.
Homegrown is produced by the always upbeat Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm the always upbeat Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.